Today is Friday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the UN says at least 180,000 people have been displaced since the Turkish incursion into Syria last month as U.S. forces return to the border east of Kazmishli.
The public knows that something was going on, and right now the question is, can the Democrats convince those independents and moderates that what was going on was serious?
Plus, the latest on the impeachment inquiry as it moves forward, and we take a look at who puts on New York's famed marathon. Those stories and more next. The UN says at least 180,000 people have been displaced since the Turkish incursion into Syria last month, adding to the 6.5 million already displaced. In addition, Turkish forces have captured 18 Syrian government soldiers in northeastern Syria as U.S. troops return to the border east of Kamishli. But to get more on the information on the ground and a whole lot more, we're joined by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what can you tell us about what is taking place on the ground in Syria?
Well, Turkey and Russia have launched their joint patrols. This joint patrol, remember we had talked a lot about this safe zone on the border with Turkey. This extends beyond that safe zone. That is the key. But the Kurds kind of signed a deal with the Russians saying that if you give us more time, we'll pull out. They, according to Russia, have been able to pull out, and now they're starting to patrol that border. Turkey has released, I believe they had another casualty today, so I think they're up to 12 or 13 killed so far since this incursion began. But the U.S. forces, as you recall, are not in this area. This is something totally being done by Turkey and Russia against the Kurds. This is not something that the U.S. is taking part in at all.
Really quickly, the Islamic State militant group announced that it had identified a replacement for al-Baghdadi, who was killed in U.S. operations. Has the Pentagon responded to that announcement?
The Pentagon has seen the announcement. The selection was Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi. That's a long name, but that is the new leader, according to the Amaq news agency that the Islamic State has. The Pentagon has said pretty much, you know, another leader, another person to target. And several senators came out and said essentially the same thing. I think Senator Ben Sasse was saying that this is another murderous person that we get to target and kill. That's pretty much the how the Pentagon is viewing this new selection. The news organization for the Islamic State, they have called him a scholar of scholars and an emir of emirs of war. So we're not really sure as to who it could be at this point, but I'm sure that we'll get more information on that in the coming months.
Really quickly, to switch gears a little bit, we have word, I believe, of a new fully operational U.S.-constructed airbase in Niger. What details can you share?
Right. So this new U.S.-constructed airbase in Agadez is now fully operational, I have been told by U.S. Africa Command, because the spokesperson for that, Colonel Chris Carnes, told me that the first unmanned intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance flights started this week. They still haven't gotten up to these multi-flights, but they have got the bare bones of the flights going, and so it is considered fully operational. The general in charge of U.S. Africa Command said that this is a display of the United States working with its African partners to counter security threats in West Africa, and that it demonstrates that the United States is committed to West Africa and the mutual security interest in the region.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives formalized the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump Thursday, passing a resolution largely along party lines setting up procedures for the next phase of the investigation. After weeks of testimony behind closed doors, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, confirmed that Democrats plan to begin public hearings. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
A historic moment in the U.S. Congress.
The yeas are 232. The nays are 196.
That also showed the deep party divides over President Trump. Republicans all voted against the measure. All but two House Democrats voted for it. The move formalizes weeks of closed-door investigations into allegations Trump pressed Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden and his son, and ordered hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to that country frozen as a way to pressure that country's leader. The move to make Trump the fourth president to face an impeachment inquiry was not taken lightly, said Speaker Pelosi.
What is at stake is our democracy. What are we fighting for? Defending our democracy for the people.
Trump tweeted immediately after the vote, calling the investigation a witch hunt. Presidential impeachments are inseparable from politics, but Democrats maintain the investigation is part of their duty as lawmakers.
For all the disagreements I have with President Trump, for all his policies, his tweets, and his rhetoric that I deeply disagree with, I never wanted our country to reach this point. I do not take any pleasure in the need for this resolution. We are not here in some partisan exercise. We are here because the facts compel us to be here.
The president's congressional allies dismissed this argument.
Clearly, there are people that we serve with that don't like the results of the 2016 election. It should not be Nancy Pelosi and a small group of people that she selects that get to determine who's going to be our president.
Republicans argue the new impeachment rules are still deeply unfair to President Trump.
It's not a fair process. It's not an open process. It's not a transparent process. But instead, it's limited and a closed process with a preordained outcome.
Public hearings are expected to begin in mid-November, likely followed by a vote on articles of impeachment that would almost certainly pass the Democratic majority House. But the resulting trial in the Republican majority Senate would favor Trump. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
U.S. President Donald Trump told the Washington Examiner he would not cooperate with congressional impeachment proceedings and might read out loud a summary of a July 25th call in which Trump asks President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate a domestic political rival. The Trump administration in September released a detailed summary of the 30-minute call, not a precise transcript, based on notes taken by aides. Current and former Trump administration officials have testified behind closed doors that the White House went outside normal diplomatic channels to pressure Zelensky to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. Mr. Trump has insisted he did nothing wrong. He said his administration would continue to not honor document requests and subpoenas. North Korea confirmed that Thursday's missile launch used super-large multiple rocket launchers, a new weapon that first debuted in August. The test sparked a fiery response from a U.S. lawmaker who called for even more sanctions against North Korea. Reuters' Eve Johnson reports.
After weeks of silence, North Korea fired up its missiles again on Thursday, testing one of its newer weapons, so-called super-large multiple rocket launchers. North Korea first debuted this new launcher in August. Official state media released a photo on Friday saying the weapon could, quote, totally destroy a target in a surprise strike, and that leader Kim Jong-un had, quote, expressed satisfaction with the results. The timing of the launch may be key. South Korea this week rolled out annual military drills, which it says are for self-defense. This is Pyongyang's first weapons test since talks with the U.S. broke down in early October. Washington wants Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons program, but the two sides have failed to reach even a basic agreement on how or when to do that. So far, no reaction from the White House. President Donald Trump has struck up a personal relationship with Kim, but he's brushed off recent tests.
Kim Jong-un has been, pretty straight with me, I think. And we're going to see what's going on. We're going to see what's happening. He likes testing missiles, but we never restricted short-range missiles. We'll see what happens.
Still, hours after Thursday's test, a Senate subcommittee sounded the alarm, accusing North Korea of, quote, escalating behavior. The chairman, Republican Cory Gardner, called for more U.S. troops to be deployed to Asia and more sanctions on North Korea. Kim has set an end-of-the-year deadline for reaching an agreement, a deadline that, according to North Korea, it would be a mistake to ignore.
And that was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. Astronomers have found a number of exoplanets whose orbits are in what is called the habitable zone. A planetary system's habitable or Goldilocks zone is an orbital region around a star where it's not too hot nor too cold, and any orbiting planets could have liquid water on its surface, something that's essential to support life. A new study from Rice University in Houston, Texas, suggests simply residing in a star's habitable zone may not be enough to determine a planet's actual habitability. The planet's star also needs to be on its best behavior. According to the study, a number of Earth-like planets found orbiting in the habitable zone also circle too close to their stars to escape the effects of the star's strong magnetic fields and associated radiation. The study authors are building a computer model to help determine how a star's atmosphere and magnetic fields affect planets in its habitable zone. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The deaths of 39 migrants, many believed to be from Vietnam, in the back of a refrigerated truck near London last week has focused a spotlight on the lives of those who risk everything to earn a better living in Britain. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, many Vietnamese are lured overseas by the potential profits of working in illegal industries.
Unseen and unheard, hidden in Britain's shadow economy, many migrants who enter Britain illegally are keen to profit from industries that are unlawful and unregulated. Tamsin Barber, an expert on Vietnamese diaspora in Britain, says many are willing to take huge risks.
And they're doing that because they know that when they get to the UK, the likelihood is they're going to be able to find work in the cannabis industry, where they might be able to earn large amounts of money in a short period of time, paying back their debts, the debts to the smugglers, and then eventually being able to pay, send remittances back to their family.
As well as the illegal cannabis industry, many Vietnamese work in nail salons, which have boomed on British streets in recent years. Others work in the restaurant trade as cleaners, some in prostitution. Once here, many migrants are trapped, says Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch.
When they get to the UK, the debt bondage, that huge debt, $30,000 to $40,000, is taken from their wages. If they don't behave or if they don't follow instructions, there could be also ramifications for their family back in Vietnam from those people smuggling gangs.
Some migrants endure slave-like conditions.
They're scared to death that if they are reported or somehow seek out the authorities because they're being abused so badly, that all that will happen is they'll be arrested and sent back to Vietnam, still owing a large debt.
Despite the risks, sending a family member overseas is often a joint decision, says Tamsin Barber.
The methods that families might use to try and raise this sort of money, which might be selling land, it might be remortgaging their houses, it might be borrowing money from moneylenders at very high sort of interest rates.
If successful, the profits can transform communities back home. In Do Tan, south of Hanoi, rundown shacks are being replaced with luxury villas. Nguyen Van Toy is a local resident. Originally, he says, the entirety of Do Tan commune was just farmers working in the fields. But then some people went overseas to work, where they got rich. That's why many people rushed to go, both flying there legally and using illegal underground routes. That illegal route ended in tragedy for 39 migrants crossing to Britain.
They're taking these dangerous routes, and it's likely they're still going to continue to come because there's so much to be gained from their migration here in the UK.
The potential profits versus the terrifying risks. Such is the dilemma facing migrants seeking a better life in Britain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In Hong Kong, anti-government protesters got into the spirit of Halloween Thursday night, mingling with revelers. Many of them wore masks specifically chosen to send a political message. Police used tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesters, many dressed in black and wearing the now banned face masks in Nathan Road, one of the main arteries of the Kowloon Peninsula. The chief superintendent of police public relations justified the use of such measures.
Halloween turned into horror for many as violent protesters hijacked festive celebration to go on a rampage in Central and Mong Kok, in Lan Kwai Fong, the area was closed at 7:30 p.m. due to overcrowding. But then the crowds turned violent and started to hurl objects at police officers. This necessitated our use of force, including tear gas, for dispersal. And history repeated itself in Mong Kok. Rioters start street fires, inflicted extensive damage to public properties and transport facilities.
Hong Kong protesters plan flash mob demonstrations in shopping malls Friday after a night of clashes in the Central Bar District. Prominent pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong has called for 100,000 people to take to the streets on Saturday. Protesters are seeking universal suffrage for Hong Kong, whose chief executive is chosen by 1,200 largely establishment figures from a list of Beijing-approved candidates. China said it will perfect the way the leader is appointed and replaced without giving details. Lebanese citizens demanding political change are maintaining their roadblocks across the tiny Mediterranean country, only allowing security and medical personnel through as demonstrations entered a third week. Protesters are standing in rare national unity, blaming the political establishment for rampant corruption and poor public services. They're also demanding a complete overhaul of Lebanon's sectarian-based politics. Dale Gavlak reports on their chances of success.
Jordanian political analyst Labib Kamhawi says the widespread discontent among Lebanese citizens and their demands to end the entire structure of governance have been expected for some time. And now the Lebanese, be they Christian, Sunni Muslim, Shiite or Druze, say they have had enough.
The continual deterioration in almost all aspects of life, including environment, taxation, rampant corruption, the garbage issue, and now the fires that hit Lebanon and destroyed a good lot of its greenery, and then the unfair taxation that was introduced by the draft budget, which was cancelled, created a feeling amongst Lebanese that they are all in the same boat, and a general conviction that they cannot trust the political status quo. All of these guys are corrupt and they have to go.
Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned earlier in the week, a key demand of protesters that followed the destruction of their tents by Shiite Hezbollah forces. But President Michel Aoun has asked him to stay on as a caretaker prime minister. In Lebanon's delicate religious mosaic, where the president is a Christian, the prime minister a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of parliament a Shiite, some believe that Hariri might lead a technocratic administration to address the financial crisis and meet protester demands. But Maha Yahya, who heads the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, doesn't see that happening. Protesters, she says, do not accept it, adding that Hariri is in a standoff with Lebanon's Shiite Hezbollah. She says that without the full support of Lebanon's political class, any government could be doomed. Kamhawi says that now the Lebanese are unified in the revolt without reference to their religious affiliations, they will likely demand a new political system and will not accept Aoun as president.
Rebuilt as a Lebanese system and not a confessionist system. If Aoun feels that he has to leave, he might entrust the formation of the government to the head of the army and he will be serving as acting president. This government, headed by the military, could oversee a new referendum or a new constitution. I don't see any other way out if they insist that Aoun should resign.
Analysts say that Lebanon faces a looming financial and economic crisis. If there is an economic collapse and the Lebanese pound loses value, Yahya says, the fallout in terms of public anger could pale in comparison to what we've seen so far. Lebanon is $86 billion in debt, which accounts for 150% of its gross domestic product. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Two officials told Reuters news agency that the Trump administration is withholding $105 million in security aid for Lebanon. The officials did not say why the aid was blocked, and VOA has not been able to independently confirm the claim. Washington has expressed concern about the growing influence of Hezbollah in the Beirut government. The armed Shiite group is backed by Iran, and the U.S. considers it a terrorist organization. The aid includes things like night vision goggles and weapons used in border security. Lebanese President Michel Aoun called for the formation of a new government Thursday. This Sunday, the world will witness the 49th TCS New York City Marathon. With over 50,000 runners competing in a grueling 42.2-kilometer course throughout all five New York City boroughs, this marathon is the largest long-distance race on the planet and attracts both amateur and elite professional athletes from around the world, including an outsized elite contingent from East Africa. Now, to find out more about this year's TCS New York City Marathon and all that goes into it, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the race director, Jim Hine.
Up front, you got the best marathon runners in the world. And then you got thousands upon thousands of people coming up behind them. And you got live national TV, over a million spectators on the streets. It's the city coming to life.
It sounds like, in addition to being a world-class sporting event, the marathon is kind of a festival.
It's the largest marathon in the world. It's frankly one of the most logistically complex marathons in the world, too. So just getting everyone out to Staten Island, Fort Wadsworth, for the start, is a massive event in and of itself. Right? There's over 800 buses involved, 24,000 people in Staten Island Ferry, and it takes a while. And then we get them into the fort, and then people are looking up at that Verrazano Narrows Bridge, and it can be intimidating. Then once you finally get up onto that bridge, and the cannon starts you, and then New York, New York is playing, you are part of something that is way bigger than you, and it's an emotional and spiritual experience. We actually have non-denominational religious services. We have Jewish minion services. We have roving psych teams of psychologists. We have therapy dogs and all the amenities you could possibly ask for to make them as comfortable as possible before they go out on this amazing journey.
The marathon is so New York in a way. Everything's just humming along despite all the odds.
Humming along. It's a million different operations coming together for one purpose. For our team, we call it all the time ducks in a pond. You know, above the water where people can see the duck is gliding along. Below the water, we're paddling like heck. But that's what we love to do, roll out the red carpet for everybody.
That everybody includes runners from all over the globe, including, of course, East Africa, where many of the most elite runners come from.
The most diverse running group you could ever assemble. About 20,000 folks will be coming from overseas. So we got an event Friday evening called the Marathon Opening Ceremony, like an Olympic-style opening ceremony with delegations representing over 130 countries. And we have delegations marching with their country's flag. So we celebrate the global nature of the race.
And then there's all the volunteers, thousands of them.
In total, 12,000 volunteers. That's an amazing thing in and of itself, right? This community owns this event. There are fluid stations in Brooklyn, frankly, throughout the whole thing. But get this one in my mind in Brooklyn that's got four generations of family members that come out every single year to volunteer. It's woven into the fabric of the city, and the ownership is just incredible.
What are some of the other things volunteers do?
They're supporting every single event that we're doing race week on the part of the build-up. And then race day, a lot of them are handing out water and Gatorade and medals and then guiding folks, getting back their baggage and guiding folks to transportation. So lots of stewarding of folks. And then race day, getting them underway, handing out water and Gatorade, post-finish, handing out medals and heat sheet blankets and the recovery bags. So every step of the way, you're engaged with volunteers all the way through. It's an amazing opportunity to be part of someone's lifetime moment.
Health and safety issues are also key. How do you deal with that?
The medical system is incredible. There's 37 medical facilities along the route, hundreds and hundreds of doctors and nurses and students and the like. So if you think of that, 4,000 and 5,000 folks that will be in some sort of medical capacity, huge operation. And the fact that we have such a robust medical system is what keeps it so that we can operate this race safely and not overwhelm all the emergency rooms throughout the city because we're able to take care of folks right there.
What about the weather?
We watch weather like a hawk. Knock on wood, next weekend things are looking good, but you got to pre-plan for every type of weather you can possibly have. And then it's not a race course. This is New York City, right? So converting the city into a course for a day in a city that's constantly evolving, and you've got to work with the city on any construction and what's going to be the impacts there, and any bike lanes going in everywhere, which is great, but bike lanes also affect what we do. What's amazing is the city is just as much a part of us as we are. They're right there with us. It means the world to them, too. So the cooperation and the buy-in from all the city agencies, that's the only reason that we're able to put on the largest marathon in the world. It's pretty amazing stuff.
And that was Jim Hine. He's the race director for the New York Roadrunners, the nonprofit group that organizes the TCS New York City Marathon. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Nick Ivanov, and of course our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an amazing weekend.